I'm Christopher Lighten with the master storyteller Tracy Kidder, who's found a kernel of inspiration in a continent of bad news. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University. An American conversation with global attitude is what we do. The bad news in this case is the ongoing mass murder and underlying misery in East Central Africa, the Rwanda neighborhood, hard by the killing fields in the Congo today. The inspiration in Tracy Kidder's best-selling story of Strength in What Remains is a young man named Deo, short for the Latin Deo Gratias, meaning thanks be to God, who goes back to his blighted roots in Burundi to put his American medical education at the service of war's survivors. What Tracy Kidder and I are talking about here is how to generalize that Deo story to the scale of the African problem and the policies from outside that have been anything but a solution. Tracy Kidder, you've done it again. I mean, you've created a sort of world historical character in this miraculous person, Deo. Deo Gratias, thanks be to God. He's a man wounded beyond the limits of endurance, but he endures. Not only endures, but he appears to be healing himself by going to medical school and then returning to the scene of his family's devastation and building a health clinic in what might have been called an enemy community. So many implications here in a story with thousands, maybe millions of individual counterparts around the world. But we'll get to the implications. Tell us the story of Deo.
Right. Well, he was a young medical student in Burundi, finishing his third year, or just finished with his third year. He was working in a remote village in a very large hospital, and the civil war broke out. And he narrowly escaped by leaving his door to his room open by mistake and hiding under his bed. So the men who would have killed him thought he had left already. He then made a 6 months long escape on foot, which took him to Rwanda, where 6 months after the beginning of civil war in Burundi, the genocide began. He escaped back from Rwanda, got to the capital of Burundi, and with the help of a friend who had a European father, he ended up leaving the country on Aeroflot, and he ended up in New York City with $200 in his pocket, no English, no friends or relations, and memories of horror so fresh that he sometimes confused past and present. And he had an unsteady time in New York. First day on a subway, he got lost for most of a day. He eked out a sort of living, delivering groceries. He slept first in abandoned tenements and then in Central Park. And then, thanks to the kindness of strangers, an ex-contemplative nun and then a childless couple, he ended up, you know, with a family, really being essentially adopted by them. And less than 2 years after he'd come to the United States, he was enrolled as an undergraduate at Columbia University. It's pretty remarkable. But even more remarkable than that, you said he began to heal himself through going back to medicine. I think in a way he began to heal himself by starting to heal other people back in his own country. This is the remarkable thing. The most remarkable thing is that Deo, you know, he was an American citizen, didn't have to go back to a country that, you know, really, after 13 years of civil war, is really quite devastated. Public health facilities are virtually non-existent. Patients are imprisoned in hospitals if they can't pay their bills. And they went back and, I mean, he had rallied all these American friends. He has legions of friends and his friends at Partners in Health, Paul Farmer's organization, and created a clinic and public health system in a rural village. And I think it's been a wonderful for him, although it's cost him some things. It interrupted once again his medical education. But it's treated 28,000 people in its first year and a half. It's growing. It's beloved by its community. And you know, it provides care free to those who can't afford to pay. What moves me about it is that Burundi was torn apart by largely artificial differences between two groups of people. Differences that were exaggerated for the advantage of a few, starting with the Germans and Belgians, particularly the Belgians. What Deo has done, seems to me, is to offer an antidote, or the beginning of an antidote, or the beginning of a potential antidote, which is to build something that is focused on something that unites all of us, which is our common vulnerability to illness and injury, our common hope for life. I find this very moving.
Mm.
So do we all. From the beginning of this story, this young man is, he has waking and sleeping nightmares. He can't sleep for the longest time. He has these visions of blood and death. I mean, this is a severely traumatized guy. But he and you introduce the sort of thematic word early on, this Gusimbara.
Gusimbura. It's actually Gusimbura.
Gusimbura.
It's hard to pronounce.
Got to remember it. But in effect, don't go there. Let's not remember. Put that out of your mind. And he's heard it from childhood in a certain way.
Yeah.
Even before the particular troubles. I'd like you to just take that word apart because it is so not what we've grown up with. Mm-hmm. You got to remember everything. Don't forget.
Right. And if you have psychological difficulty, what you want to do is confront it. I have a linguist friend who thinks that it knows of no other language, and not to say there isn't one, that has a single word for this. Gusimbura means to remind people of something unpleasant by naming the dead. Kurundi, also the language of Burundi, also has another word, which is more general, which just means to remind people of something unpleasant, a single word. It's not a good thing to do. It's a verb, and you gusimbura someone. It's worse than impolite. So it's not something you want to do. And I found myself writing toward the end of this book as I went on this relentless journey with Deo to memorial sites, to the genocide in Rwanda, that, you know, at a certain point, of course we have to remember all this. Otherwise there's no hope that never again will ever be anything more than an empty platitude. But there is also something, you know, too much remembering can suffocate a person or a culture. And, you know, so I think there's also some deep wisdom in a culture with a word like Gusimbura.
Well, even he says it, and you say it in the book, with a profound irony. At some point, I think you ask him, will you ever be able to forget, or will people be able to forget this? And
how long will it take for the people to forget here in Rwanda?
Yeah.
And he
says, it'll probably take the time that the earth has left.
That's right. Yes.
So we're not going to remember, but of course it's with us every moment of our waking and sleeping life.
Yeah.
In what sense is he practicing, ironically or not, a philosophy of let's get on with it?
I think in every sense. I mean, I think for him the answer, you know, he went to Columbia. One of the fascinating things about his career at Columbia is that while he majored in biochemistry, he also majored in philosophy. I asked him why, and he said, because I wanted to understand what had happened to me. And like all students of philosophy, he didn't get answers, he got more questions. But he did get room, space and time for his mind to begin to turn over these questions in tranquility, I think. And I think what he found is that, you know, sometimes the answer is in your hands. You know, you have to do something. So I think for him it's neither been forgetting nor, remembering incessantly, but actually acting, you know, doing something. And this act, I mean, of building a clinic and public health system, I mean, it is of enormous value. And that's the main point of it, enormous value to others. I mean, he's an effective idealist, like his friend and mentor, Paul Farmer. But it also, in his case, you know, he tried to do this when he was a high school student. He tried to build a clinic that would serve the kind of people he'd grown up among. And he failed repeatedly. So in a way that this seems to me like a sewing back together of a life that was torn in two by war. I think it is the acting that ultimately is the solution for him. It's not to say that it's anybody else's solution. It's just that it astonishes me that he's gone back at all, since I can't imagine having done the same thing in his place. And he has no political ambitions. My God, he just wants to help his country.
I want you to help sort of tease out the lessons here for a suffering world. I mean, maybe 30 million refugees wandering this world as we speak.
Is that all?
Well, it could be, you're right. I mean, many, many more. War devastation, and all parts of the world too, not just Africa. But I'm thinking of this partly in the context of Darfur. Nicholas Kristof on one hand in the New York Times, column after column, saying we've got to do something, save Darfur, it's up to us, the world must intervene. And on the other hand, to me, a very interesting writer at Columbia University, an Indian actually who grew up in Uganda, Mahmoud Bamdani. And he takes just a very different view mm-hmm. that we often, more often than not, make things worse. We have to understand before we act. There are African ways of solving these things in amid populations of herders and farmers who've been reacting to drought and each other in changing ways for hundreds and hundreds of years. Mamdani calls it the difference between victor's justice, in which the righteous powers come in and say, you're the bad guys, you're going to suffer, we're putting you away, and the truth and reconciliation notion of, hey, we all live here, we were all in on it, we're going to all be here for centuries, we better work it out among ourselves. In your man Dale, I see a sort of one survivor at a time kind of justice. He's going to stand up without comparisons, without waiting for other people, and start surviving, giving his own example. Where do we come down between our own responsibility of the past and in the future as outsiders? And what is Deo telling us about, you know, what people can do, must do on their own?
Well, I don't know that Deo has really spent a lot of time thinking about these things. I mean, you know, I think he's been really focused on trying to do something. I think of his clinic and his effort here as, you know, an instrument of peace, a small enactment of, in miniature of what Obama was talking about in Ghana recently, where he was talking about African and American cooperation, mutual responsibility. This is, Deo's clinic is a perfect example of it. People have been coming from all over the country to go to this clinic, and even some have been coming from Congo and Tanzania to this Village Healthworks clinic. And in fact, some have come not to get care, but just to see the place. And Deo asked one of them why, and he said, to see America, which I thought was pretty amazing. Yeah. But as for me, I'm not familiar with I have not done the reading on Darfur. I've read Mamdani on Rwanda with great interest and pleasure, but I don't know these views on. It's almost a truism to say that, you know, you shouldn't be intervening in places that you don't understand, you know. And it's also, I think, very important for us always to remember that Africa is not one big dysfunctional country. Most Americans seem to think that, or many do. You know, all these situations are different, and they all call for something different. But I don't think that the wealthy Western nations have any right to abandon attempts to try to reconcile these things. But just to go to the question of truth and reconciliation, there's a very interesting book about the aftermath of violence in Burundi written by the academic dean at the Fletcher School here at Tufts, Peter Uven. A book I really loved. He went and after the peace had come, he went and interviewed a really good representative cross-section of Burundian society. And one of the things that he found that's very interesting is an absolute lack of interest in truth and reconciliation commissions. And the feeling was that people who did commit crimes did it mostly. Now, I'm not talking about the elites, the entrepreneurs of violence who were always in the background in these things, but the people who killed out of fear. And I think the feeling is it summed up in something Deo said to me once. They were not themselves. They were something else. Fear had an enormous part to play in the kind of mayhem that went on in that civil war. So I'm assured by Burundian friends, and that was my sense. What Uven said. People did say they would love to talk to people who were on the other side, but they usually want the other side to apologize first. So I mean, you know that. I think that Burundi is a very different case from Rwanda. That's another important thing. I mean, even though you have countries where they speak essentially the same language and have the same customs, the same taste for banana beer, the same religions, you have different history, a different history, part of which is shrouded because we don't have records of much in the way of records before colonialism. But Burundi was a more fluid society, a society in which this ethnic difference was not ever as important, in part because the place was more complicated. I think that most Burundians would probably tell you, we don't want to talk about this. We don't want to think about this anymore. We are desperately poor. We want to live. We're not interested in the ethnic problems. I mean, after all, the majority now owns the reins of government, and actually that party is a multi-ethnic party. I don't think ethnicity is the real deep issue there, although some may attempt to make it back into one. The real deep issue there is, you know, the size of the pie and then who gets the biggest pieces of the little tiny pie. Mm. And I think that Burundi's peace is fragile, but I think one can have hope for it. After all, you know, it was 13 years of war, and it was brutal. I mean, hundreds of thousands died. The usual number is 300,000, but I don't think anyone knows for sure, as in most of those cases. So I don't know what to say about Darfur and Sudan. I don't even know what prescriptions to give you for Burundi, but I do know that the kind of thing that Deo started, this Village Health Works, is potentially part of a prescription for peace and
I want to believe it.
Prosperity. I do believe it. And I mean, I'm going to take it on faith because, I mean, I can't prove it, you know.
No, and we may have no better chance. On the question of American hand in this, it's not as if there wasn't American training, American medicine, American ideals, a vision of America. Even, as you say, the Burundians come to the clinic to see America. It's not that we're not engaged. But there is a difference between that sort of thing and police forcing or sanctions or all the other instruments that we're accustomed to using.
Yeah, I wouldn't for a moment say that this was the whole solution. I just think it's part of some of what needs to be done. I think one of the things that often gets overlooked, and one of the reasons I admire Uven's work so much, is that it is certainly true that poverty didn't cause the genocide in Rwanda or the civil war in Burundi, but it was the essential backdrop, the essential setting of both of those catastrophes. And you simply have to grapple with that fact. I mean, we are talking about unbelievable poverty, unbelievable to us. And ill health, of course, is only the end result of a lot of other kinds of problems that usually start with poverty. Doesn't necessarily follow that working on health isn't a good way to begin to redress some of those problems, since, after all, there's nothing really much more basic than that. For instance, if you have desperate poverty in a country and you have an elite vying for power and privilege, or several elites, the stakes are really big. They're magnified. Here in the United States, you lose your party loses the election, you go and get a job at a think tank or a university or something like that. That's not the way it works in a very poor country, unless you've already stockpiled a lot of money in Switzerland. I mean, the stakes are very big, and the stakes are very big for people sort of in the middle. So, you know, those countries are by definition fragile. I'm looking toward a much more enlightened foreign policy on matters such as these coming from this administration. I'm hoping for it.
Somebody in your book, and it may be Deo, asked to dope out the lethal violence and the scale of it, says at some point it's about a response to humiliation, to decades, generations, maybe centuries of deep poverty, and then colonialism too. What's the best sorting out you've heard of
the causes?
Yeah.
Well, I think that was actually Deo who was saying that. I mean, the best sorting out usually for me is just a narrative. I think René Lemarchand, a lot of this history is vexed. There are a lot of people who seem to take sides, some of the scholars. Uven seems very open and even-handed. Everything fits in. I mean, you can't dismiss any single cause, and anybody who harps on a single cause, you know, is bound to be wrong, you know. The countries are very densely populated. They are agrarian. They don't have a lot of natural resources. They're very beautiful, but both Rwanda and Burundi. They're not, and as I said, they're not the same. In fact, they're almost like mirror images of each other politically. But I don't know. I think you have to consult all of these sources. I leaned on Peter Uven because I trust him completely on these things. I think he knows the history really well. He knows the country really well. I think he would say it's many, many things, you know, that you can't just name one. But he would not leave out what he calls structural violence, borrowing that term, you know, which is having spent a fair amount of time in Haiti with Paul Farmer, I'm familiar with that. With that, both that idea and with the reality of it.
Explain it.
Well, I mean, you have war where people are actively killing each other, that's dreadful. I don't mean to minimize the dreadfulness of that. But in a country like Haiti, which is not at war, you have what resembles war every day. People dying of, as they say in Haiti, of stupid diseases. I mean, just a massacre of people. People dying of, you name it, you know. And the same is true in Burundi. Stupid illnesses, things are so easily handled. You know, people living, as Deo says, you know, with worms. Worms become your friends, you know, intestinal worms. Kids dying of measles, dying of mostly dirty water. Horrific rates of maternal mortality, each one of which is a cascade of catastrophes, as a Cuban doctor once said to me. So, you know, I think that's what Deo in part was talking about, is not necessarily the cause of this war. I can tell you the various political events that were the cause of Burundi's civil war. If you read the history of colonialism and you see how the Belgians with their divide and rule strategy did, taking what in Burundi at least was an important social difference, but not the most important social difference, and exaggerating it for their own use so that they could have a cadre of people who would rule in their stead, so they wouldn't have to spend a lot of money running the joint. And it isn't, as Uven once pointed out to me, there was a whole lunatic racist idea about this having to do with, you know, the Ham, the son of Noah, and so on. But what really matters, of course, ideas matter, but what really matters is the institutions that you put in place and what those do to people, and terrible discrimination against Hutus and against many Tutsis, but it was much worse for Hutus in both countries during colonialism. And you had your identity inscribed on a card and so on and so forth. And that really determined your fate. And it also, you know, among other things, determined whether you got to school or not to a large degree. And then in Burundi, I mean, but in Burundi, you had a small Tutsi elite, military elite, taking over after colonialism and ruling through violence. So you'd have these uprisings of the majority or parts of the majority. They could be very brutal, horrific, and then they would be put down by the army in even more brutal and horrific ways. And that reached its apogee in 1972, when there was a selective genocide of all the Hutu intellectuals who could possibly compete for power, an insane act, and that stoked the fires, it seems to me. I don't believe in historical necessity, but if you read the colonial history and then you read about the years immediately following, it does seem as though the fate of the country was sealed, you know.
On the construction of labels and warring identities, Mahmoud Mandani would say something very similar. It was created by the British census in Darfur, in Sudan. You're an Arab. I'm an African. We have the same color. We have the same religion. But there is a contest built into those distinctions. Where do you come out in the end on what this constructed difference between Hutus and Tutsis is all about? People talk about hairlines, shapes of nose, tall, squat, differences, and yet your man Deo was brought up just to put it aside. Father said, forget about that. Don't go there. It's not true. It's not interesting. It's not productive. Forget about it. Don't bring it up again. And it sort of runs through the book in a way, even to the end, that where his clinic is serving, he's a Tutsi, but his clinic is serving Hutus, that we don't know, almost don't want to know what these phrases are all about.
I think many people in Burundi don't, absolutely do not want to know. Also, during Deo's childhood, the discussions of ethnicity were virtually a taboo. I mean, after all, if you were a member of, if you were a Tutsi in the village, you were outnumbered by your Hutu neighbors. And if you were a Hutu, you knew that the army was never very far away. But these people had lived together for centuries. And, you know, as for these physical differences, those are sort of perhaps exist in stereotypes, but it's always worth remembering that there were people in Rwanda, for instance, who were slaughtered, Hutus, because they supposedly looked like Tutsis. This was all nonsense handed down by the Belgians, you know, who measured people and so on. I know Tutsis who aren't anywhere near tall enough to be Tutsis by the Belgian standards. I mean, in Deo's own looks, you know, measuring the width of noses and, there's stuff about gum color and hairlines. It's utter baloney, in my view. I mean, I'm not a Burundian or a Rwandan, God knows, but and I can't speak for them. But in fact, I get very nervous blathering about this stuff myself because, you know, really what I set out to do, Chris says, I find an interesting person and then I get myself interested in the world that occupies him. But he's my first interest. I mean, I'm interested in telling these stories. I don't have prescriptions for all of these sorts of things, you know, for answers to Darfur, to the great questions of genocide and civil war. I don't think anyone does have those answers. But if we want to begin to approach an understanding of those things, I think we need to go to various different sources. We need theory. We need broad history. We need the kind of writing in which people take on the big questions. They may use a character, an individual here and there as to illustrate a point, but a point about something that matters more to them, which is the fate of populations. For me, it works kind of the other way around. And I mean, and I still think that you couldn't understand the Nazi Holocaust or begin to approach an understanding of it unless you also, in addition to all the big books on it, you also read something like Primo Levi's The Periodic Table. I think we need all of these things to begin to understand.
We need Kidder. Let's be clear about that. And I'm serious. Not only the theoretical and the policy types, but citizens like me need a human frame around which to imagine not only his story, but the implications for the rest of us. I want you to come back to, I mean, you're talking about hoping for a more enlightened Obama-era policy for this whole mm-hmm. world. How might one, I don't want to make you a theorist or a okay. Secretary of State, but what are the implications of this man's story for building a policy of recovery, development, health in its all its senses in East Africa and elsewhere? Mm-hmm. I mean, tease it out. What is he telling? What is Deo telling us?
I think he's, oh man, I think he's telling us that we have to pay attention to the actual conditions of people there. We have to pay attention to things like if we want to talk about corruption, for instance, we have to think hard about our own part in that. I mean, the fact that the United States ties a larger percentage of its aid than any other of the Western donor nations. By ties, I mean insists that a larger percentage of it go back to American pockets. There are projects, USAID projects, where half the money never leaves Washington. By the time it gets out, it's like the Rio Grande. It never gets to the people out there in the countryside. It isn't even a trickle. We've got to fix that because that's our fault. A lot of that is our fault. And, you know, I think what Obama said about mutual responsibility is correct. I think you have to look at what Deo has done as modeled to a large degree on what what Partners in Health has done in Rwanda, in Haiti, in Malawi, Lesotho, Peru, the former Soviet Union, in Russia. You know, I mean, I think you have to get on the ground and you have to have people who speak the language, who know what's going on. You have to really consult the people you're trying to help, you know, find out what it is they think they need and what they want. It's not tremendously complicated. It's just a lot of difficult work, and it's not the kind of work that some people really like to do. You know, you can't do it in Washington, D.C. You can make some changes there that are important. But I must say, one of the reasons, things that gives me great hope, is that, you know, there was a nasty incident at this clinic not so long ago, and the American response was really wonderful and heartening. The ambassador came out to the clinic. The ambassador, as I understand it, is tremendously interested in trying to keep the peace in Burundi. To exert American influence for peace, you know, was a fairly novel idea, I think. Also, the fact that that Paul Farmer is the assistant to Bill Clinton, the special envoy to Haiti, for instance. I think this may be the first real opportunity in our lifetimes, and maybe the last, for real substantial progress to be made in Haiti. Given, I mean, we've got, you know, people who think about these things love to use that term political will. But, you know, and usually the political will that seems to be lacking is lacking in the wealthy countries. It may be lacking in the others as well. But that's where we ought to start, it seems to me. And I think that what this administration is showing, we'll see how it comes out, you know, but that one little instance gives me great hope.
There's a wonderful story you tell somewhere about they need a road around this clinic.
Yeah.
And they put out bids, and the usual contractors come up with sky-high bids for bring all their equipment in, and a woman comes forth and says, forget the bidder.
Can I read this?
Please, I wish you would.
This is Deo speaking about his clinic at a fundraiser. About the road that goes up this mountain to the clinic. And I'll just read it. Speaking at a fundraiser in New York, Deo told this story. This past summer, we needed some help to make a road that goes to our site passable. A friend of mine told me, well, Deo, there's a great Belgian construction company that builds roads in Burundi and Rwanda and the Congo. And I was so excited. So I went to talk to the representative of the company. He sent someone to look at the road and estimated a cost of at least $50,000. Not to pave the road, but just to widen it and make it passable. I went back frustrated, wondering how to tell the Kayanza community this bad news. As I was explaining this to them, one woman with a baby crying on her back said to me, you will not pay a penny for this road. We become so much sick because we are poor, but we are not poor because we are lazy. We will work on this road with our own hands. The next day, 166 people showed up with pickaxes, hoes, machetes, and other tools. One of the volunteers was a woman who came to work with a sick child. When a friend of mine and I looked at the baby, we saw that the baby was sweating. I then asked the mother why she came to work with a child that sick, and she said to me, well, I've already lost 3 children, and I know this one is next, whether I stay at home or come to work here. So it's better for me to join others and make my contribution, which hopefully will help to save someone else's child who will be sick but alive when you have a clinic in Kayanza. The entire road, 6 kilometers long, was rebuilt by these people with machetes and hoes. The same day the road was finished, the representative of the Belgian road construction company called me to negotiate the price. You can imagine how I felt to get that call from him. I said to him, thank you so much for your call, but it's already done. He was obviously shocked and said to me, what do you mean? Who did it? We are the only road construction company in the entire region. And I said, not anymore. I mean, in the end, you know, it's all these things have to work in concert. I'm not a development expert. How you can assemble on a grand scale the kind of effort that Deo and some other NGOs have made, in other places. This whole concatenation of things going right for a change instead of things going wrong. I don't know, but a lot of it does have to do with. Deo was very smart about this and making sure that this was that the community had a big say in this. And one of the really interesting things I think about this is that, you know, if you're doing public health, you have to clean up the water supplies. You've got to do something about sanitation, but you very quickly have to turn to women's health. It's the probably the biggest problem in these poor countries. Deo, when he started this clinic, made a committee and he put a majority of women on it. He thought that might solve the problem, but it didn't because the men did all the talking, the women did all the work. So he made 2 committees against the protests of some of the men. And the women's committee pretty soon just took over. And they have a real say in the running of the clinic, and it makes an enormous difference. Too often what happens is people start out with good intentions from the Western world, and they even raise pretty substantial sums of money to do their work. But then things start to go wrong. They buy fleets of SUVs for their own use in the country. They call for big, huge conferences of experts, many of whom don't even speak the local language. And then they get there and they discover it's really hard to work in a place like Haiti or Burundi, and pretty quickly declare defeat. And in the worst cases, what they end up doing is, but just before they leave, they blame the people that were supposed to come and help in the first place. Partners in Health never does that, and Village HealthWorks will never do that. You know, they make mistakes, of course, but usually when they make them, they go back to the people themselves in one way or another. I mean, and try to figure out whether they went wrong, you know, and they don't leave.
Your man Yuvin says, you know, the aid workers go into the big houses, reestablish a kind of colonial framework, and it's...
They can make things worse, actually. Yeah. I don't think that the conclusion should be that we should... just give up because it's impossible. In fact, I mean, I consider effective foreign aid is a debt that is owed by the West to many of these countries, such as Haiti, which has been a virtual colony of the United States. Certainly Europe owes some big debts to many countries in Africa. But it has to be done differently. It clearly hasn't worked. I mean, part of the problem may be fragmentation of efforts. That certainly seems to me a problem in Haiti, where enormous sums of money have been spent for very small gains. On the other hand, I mean, one of the reasons I was so moved by Partners in Health, and which is, again, as I said, is the inspiration for Village HealthWorks, is that they really are effective. And that's their whole MO. They're not trying to, these are not middle-class employment projects. In Haiti, right now, there are very few Americans working on their project. They have now 3 million patients that they serve directly. They haven't solved all the problems, but they are trying to define public health in the broadest terms possible, to include schooling, to include, nutrition, and as well as, clean water and sanitation and medicine. I think that's a pretty good example to lean on. And, I'm not the only one who thinks that. Bill Clinton thinks that, and Bill Gates seems to think so, too. I mean, the real problem in the world today, as my friend Jim Young Kim, now the president of Dartmouth, one of the founders of Partners in Health, puts it, is delivery. We have an awful lot of tools to deliver. We need new drugs, of course, for TB and so on and so forth. But with the drugs that we have, we could really change the world. We lack the will to do it, it seems to me, and we haven't developed the right ways to do it. The problem is that there's nothing that, where one size fits all. To address a slightly different issue, if you don't mind,
please.
It just occurred to me. Some people say you shouldn't write books like the one I've written, which are, about the bad news from Africa. And I find this a little, I'm suspicious when I hear this, particularly if it comes from a Westerner. Because it sounds to me like a form of political correctness, which is simply a way of a kind of self-promotion, saying I'm in possession of knowledge that the rest of you don't have. The fact is that I don't see how it's going to do countries that are suffering much good to pretend that that great things are happening. And the fact is, I didn't write a book about Africa. I wrote a book about a guy who comes from a country where there hasn't been a lot of good news for the last century or so. But there has been some, and I did write about, and the person I wrote about has produced some of it.
In an op-ed world that's still arguing about aid versus trade, Jeff Sachs says you've got to have aid to get people to the first rung. Other people say, it gets wasted, it's run out. I'm just trying to sort of expand the Deo example of something entirely
right,
different.
One of the problems with doing that, though, Chris, is that you got to be really careful. You got to build on something that's real. And it seems to me, we can't start thinking about human beings, populations, and human beings as pins on a map, And when we do that, I think is when we start to make mistakes. Certainly, obviously, you always have to make choices. Obviously, you do have to set priorities. Obviously, you do have to say sometimes that one disease is more important than another. But if you say, as was being done, for instance, in Peru, that we simply can't deal with multi-drug resistant, and in Geneva, they were saying this, we can't deal with multi-drug resistant tuberculosis because it's just too expensive and too difficult for poor countries to deal with. So in a sense, we'll pretend it doesn't exist. Well, it does exist, and it's a big threat, and it's growing. So I'm worried about trying to expand too far. I think what we need are earnest and competent endeavors that focus on, rather narrowly on, we may say, okay, we want, as Jim Kim said when he went to the WHO for a while, we want 3 million people in treatment for AIDS in the countries where there is no AIDS treatment now by the year such and such. Well, that's fine to make such a goal, but then you've got to go and do it on the ground. You've got to, and in this place, you might want to do it this way, and in that place, do it another way, and in that place, do it another. We can learn lessons from one place to another. I mean, a good example is the community health worker model, which, paid and trained people in the country, in question. This is what Partners in Health does in Haiti. This is what Deo is doing in Village HealthWorks in Burundi. these people, because certain illnesses need to be treated with drugs that have to be taken on schedule, on time, you have someone who comes and delivers those drugs and makes sure that they're taken. But these people also act as early warning about a family that may be in trouble. They become real resources for health in the community. And they can also address, come back and say, this kid, they need tuition for their kids to go to school, or the kids need shoes, or they need food. It's worked very nicely in Haiti. It's the backbone of that, and it's being employed in Rwanda right now by Partners in Health, to pretty good effect. And I might add that Partners, we have big problems in this country, of course, with our healthcare system. Partners in Health has a project here in Boston that deals with AIDS patients, primarily, who are not being well served by the standard model, which is to bring them into the hospital whenever they get really sick. Partners in Health has been using community health workers here in Boston. They have to be paid more, and it's not as simple as in Haiti. And it's probably one of the more difficult programs in all of Partners in Health's galaxy of projects. But I do think it's a fascinating technology transfer in medicine. From Haiti, where there never was enough, and to Boston, where there maybe is too much. I guess what I'm trying to say is, yes, there are, you can build on this kind of experience, certainly, and there are things you can transfer from one place to another, but you better be careful doing it. I just don't think there is going to be one grand prescription, except that we have to continue to try, and we have to continue to try to learn from our mistakes, And we do have to reform USAID. I think even the people in USAID, which is our principal source of international aid, our funding mechanism, we have to reform it. It's not the money's not getting where most Americans have a right to expect it to get.
Tracy Kidder, this is a privilege, and you're interesting without end. I have two other questions, though, I want to ask you sort of on the margins of this story in Africa. I mean, we're all reminded that the killing along the equivalent of Hutu-Tutsi lines is still going on in the Eastern Congo. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's
way
not
more
over.
Complicated than that, though.
Yeah, indeed. But do we know, do you know, does Deo know how to bring that kind of thing to an end?
No. No, he doesn't. I don't. I'm not sure. Who does? I don't know. It's horrific. And it is, in my opinion, underreported, as Burundi's war was. Burundi's war was virtually not reported, at least in our country. What's going on in Congo now, from the little that I know about it, is a true Holocaust and tremendously complicated. There are, I don't know, two dozen militias that are fighting. And, of course, there the prize is very rich mineral deposits, that the West wants, the West and the wealthy countries of the world want. But I don't know the answers. I really don't. I do think that these ethnic differences, I think these are things that they're real enough, but they are mobilized by people who have a vested interest in violence who are vying for power and privilege. It's pretty simple.
The other big question we haven't touched on is China in Africa. Big story today and every day.
But again, I'm not an expert on this. I do know that I was told anyway that the roads in Rwanda, which are very good, were built originally by the Chinese, also in Burundi during the Cold War. Those are really excellent roads, by the way.
I'm wondering if the Chinese have heard of Deo. Have they read your book?
I have no idea.
Were they? I mean, can you imagine them conspiring with his model of healthcare development, or is that just another version of, are they recapitulating the European colonialism?
I don't know. I think they're a little more cynical than, my impression, of course, it's all derived from reporting here that I get to see here in the States is my impression is they're really interested in those minerals and oil, as we are too. They seem to be a little more honest about it, and they seem to care much less about the kinds of governments they're supporting than we supposedly do, although we have a very bad record for that.
Last question. How do you explain, Tracy Kidder, beside the fact that you're a fantastic writer with a wonderful track record of important books, the best-selling takeoff of this very challenging, difficult idea in in this new one, Strengthen What Remains, instantly close to the top of the bestseller list and seems to have legs.
Oh, I don't know. I think it's... I was struck when I first heard this story by, you know, its drama and by the central character, who's absolutely charming. And I think we're wired for stories, we human beings, and this is a story. It's one way we organize the chaos of the world. I think about, okay, what's this book about? Well, of course, it's about war and genocide. Of course, it's about the kindness of strangers. It's about courage and endurance. It's about the torment of memory. But we know the truth. We know the basic truths about all those things, right? I mean, war and genocide are deplorable, and charity happens, and and there is such a thing as human resilience, and so on. But what I wanted to do, and I guess some people think I have, was to let you experience those things not as truisms, but to experience them again as we do in our lives through Deo. You know, I mean, I think that's what good writing does. It makes the world new again, and I cannot hold my, and I don't want to begin to hold myself up as an expert in how to fix these problems. I find what his one partial little solution very moving, and it's certainly been useful to 28,000 different individuals who weren't getting any medical care.
Here I go, fighting your modesty and your impulse to keep it narrow and local and a man. I keep wanting to draw out what's working here. This is a man who, first of all, he went back. Mm-hmm. Secondly, he does not compare his suffering to anybody else's. Mm-hmm. He has dealt somehow with horrific memory, mm-hmm. and kept moving. He's brought American know-how, American machinery, American friends to the project, but not weapons, not a million aid workers or all these other sorts of things. My thought would be simply that in a moment after the misadventures in Iraq and elsewhere, we're all looking for ways for this incredibly powerful culture and country and wealth of ours to relate to suffering. And holy moly, here's Deo doing a miracle one day at a time. Mm-hmm. And I do want to.
You want to generalize from this?
Yeah, of course.
Well, I'm not so sure. I mean, I could give you some general, I think general truths are
go
pretty
for
obvious.
We'll let you
well,
go.
I mean, the fact is that, first of all, to have a Burundian, you know, leading this effort in Burundi seems to me really important. And I mean, I think that's a lesson that Partners in Health, in a sense, learned. I mean, what happened was Paul Farmer made himself into a, as he would put it, a total herpetologist in Haiti. I mean, you've got to speak the language. And when I say speak the language, you've got to really speak the language. You've got to understand connotation and so on, particularly as it regards international health. I think that the effective projects are the ones that, while they have big goals and while they want to spread and so on and so forth, start with the individual patient. And you let the individual patient teach you how to treat his, her family. And you let that family teach you how to treat a village, and the village how to treat, you know, a province, and the province how to treat the nation. I do think it has to come, at least some of it. So that you can be working from both ends, but you cannot forget that essential part, which is the local, always the local. I mean, that's where we all live. So I applaud projects like Deo's. I know I also applaud projects like Deo's, which are eager to cooperate with and to share credit, or even to, you know, to forego credit with other people who are in earnest, you know, and have other areas of expertise. I can see that happening, you know, in Burundi. That's sort of my dream for it, which is that if you do this so effectively, it ought to be a beacon for the rest of the country. I mean, these Burundians are plenty smart, believe me, incredibly industrious people, and I can't help but think that when they see this shining, this city on a hill, they're going to say, we'd like that too. And, you know, and if there are people around ready to say, okay, great, let's get going. I mean, it's possible. I don't want to sound Panglossian, you know. I know that the odds are always against these kinds of things, but who the hell am I? Or who are we to declare despair on behalf of, you know, 8 million Burundians who are so much worse off than we are? I think we have to have hope for this. And I am grateful, frankly, for the existence of people like Deo in the world.
Oh, we are.
You know, I mean, so many of the forces in the world that we're familiar with every day are tending toward chaos. And, you know, it seems, I mean, I'm just glad they're there. It's a pretty simple-minded idea, but I'm sorry.
Tracy Kidder, we're glad you're there, man. And we love this book, Strength in What Remains, A Journey of Remembrance and Forgiveness, about Deo Gratias, Thanks Be to God, building a health clinic in shattered but recovering Burundi. Tracy Kidder, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Chris. It's nice to talk with you again.
Great pleasure.
Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with Tracy Kidder, whose book about Deo and the journey of remembrance and forgiveness is titled Strength in What Remains. Our Brown University interns Ben Mandelkern and Hannah Olson helped produce the talk and the podcast. Weigh in, listeners, please, starting with an idea of effective foreign aid that Tracy Kidder sees as a debt that is owed to these countries. Leave a comment, if you will, at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.